Do you have more pictures of your goats than yourself on your phone? Does your vacation time get spent attending goat shows? Can you have a conversation without bringing up dairy goats? Neither can we. So join us as we talk to the country's best breeders, judges, appraisers, and industry experts about all things dairy goats. We are John Kane and Danielle Caroli. Welcome to Ringside, an American Dairy Goat podcast. This week, we welcome Dr. Fauna Smith of the very well-known Wingwood Farm. This family, herd produces some of the nicest Nubians in the country with just about every accolade under its belt. But today, we're sitting down with Fauna to talk about DNA and genetic testing, the importance of each, and why we as breeders should collect and test our animals. Who better than the committee chair of ADCA's Genetic Advancement Committee? Welcome to the show, Dr. Fauna Smith.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, I'm super excited to delve into DNA and genetic testing and kind of learn a little bit more. And I know our listeners have definitely asked for us to touch on this, so I'm happy that we're finally delivering, and having someone such as yourself on is just, you know, icing on top of the cupcake. So
I'm glad to be able to help and answer questions about DNA typing and kind of some of the other programs related to DNA that ADCA offer. So
awesome. So I guess we'll start off how we start off every guest, and that is for anyone listening that may not know who you are, can we get the elevator pitch on yourself and your herd?
Sure. So I grew up in the goat world. So my family has had Wingwood Farm Nubian since 1974. I came into the picture in 1978. So the goats preceded both Trinity, my sister and I. I grew up doing the goat thing, but then I went off to college and to veterinary school, and actually ended up migrating to New Zealand, where I lived for 10 years as a practicing veterinarian. Before I came back to the United States to do a residency in internal medicine and a PhD, which I just finished. But in 2015, my parents are getting older, and mom was talking about selling a few of the goats, and I thought, oh, I don't want that to happen, so I'll take some of the goats. And so in 2015, I had 6 stillings that came to my place, and I freshened out those 6 yearlings that year, and over the last 7 years, I've slowly, the majority of the herd has started to live with me, and mom still has goats, quite a few, more than she probably needs at her place. But I'm milking 20 does twice a day this year. From 6 goats to 20 in 7 years. It's typical goat math, right?
That's
yeah, for sure.
The only thing is, you're counting, and I feel like most of us try not to count.
Well, I also work a full-time job, so I kind of have to count. I do have to try and keep it under control. We've got 20 does in milk, and then I don't know how many kids. I can't tell you how many kids there are. I don't want to know.
We won't ask me that question. Don't worry.
Really kind of gotten back into the goats over the last 7 years, after kind of a hiatus when I was overseas, though not really. I had a small herd of sheep and goats in New Zealand. It's just that goats are very different there, particularly Nubians, and I know you probably touched on that a little bit with Alex and
Kylie.
And that, you know, they've been using some of our genetics, but it was a bit of a culture shock for me to see what the Nubians were like in New Zealand. But yeah, so I had a few goats there, but not the Wingwood Farm Nubians, which are quite special to me. And then I start on July 1st. I actually start as an assistant professor of livestock reproduction and herd health at UC Davis at the veterinary school on July 1st.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations.
That's awesome.
Thank you. So
does this mean you're traveling to nationals and running back and starting?
No, I am not going to nationals this year. It's not in the books for the Wingwood Farm herd. Trinity is going to fly the Smith family flag at nationals with her goats on La Mancha's and the Shining Moon Alpines.
Oh, okay. And you're not sneaking a Wingwood Farm Nubian or two in her trailer, just like at the end of night, you know, drop it off and give her a cup of coffee and sorry.
No, not this time.
I would have been like, I'm going to ask for forgiveness, not permission. And thank you for taking care of this goat.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, if we hop into some of these awesome questions, first of all, obviously anybody that follows all of the committee reports and stuff knows what certain committees are, but what does the Genetic Advancement Committee actually do each year for that?
So I think the role of the Genetic Advancement Committee is evolving all the time, and particularly because the science behind genetic advancement is evolving. And so at the current state that we're in, you know, a lot of what we do are discussing the policies around DNA typing, genetic testing, and trying to come up with policies that we think are fair, useful, and are going to advance the breeding, the genetics, and our ability to use genetic testing and that type of thing in our breeding of our dairy goats. Looking forward even more, there's interest within the international dairy goat community of doing genome-wide testing, genomics for production traits and that type of thing. So maybe someday we will have like the cattle do.
Yes.
So it's really kind of the committee's role is to keep their finger on the pulse of what's going on, what's available for goats, how can we utilize genetic testing to advance dairy goats, and how can we make policies work well for our association. So we spend a lot of time discussing the current policies on the books and whether those need to be changed, and if there are new things coming up, new policies or new suggestions for how the association might use genetic testing.
Right, and it's an ever revolving door of new stuff coming down the pipeline, especially as we see with all these dairy cattle or even beef cattle. So I'm sure it's a lot of work each year to put into this committee to try to keep us towards the forefront of the testing.
Right. Correct. And also, you know, we utilize some of the other breed associations and talk to them about, you know, what their policies are. A really good example of something that we are hoping to discuss and work on this year would be an idea of a defect reporting system. So the Jersey, USA Jersey, they actually have a system where, you know, if you have a kid born with a calf born with a cleft palate, you can submit a report to the association and they'll keep a record of like all of the cleft palates that are submitted. And then if enough of them are submitted, they can actually try to determine if there's a genetic component, right? Or a genetic defect that's leading to those. Trying to do some things like that, that would be one thing that we've been discussing that's kind of new and might, you know, try to offer in the future.
That would be interesting. Yeah. Especially with like, you know, there's certain lines that produce like extra teats or, you know, yeah, that would be amazing if you could pinpoint some of that.
Right. And like thinking of those extra teats, it always seems to be, well, is this environmental? Is it a fluke that happened in utero, or is it from a line? And so kind of to start figuring out, you know, teats, color, like I'm thinking like Oberhausley, like where color is coming from, like those white spots sometimes that pop up, you know, things like that. If we could start tracking it, it would be a really nice little addition to what we could do as, you know, as
Doctors. It definitely is. The biggest hurdle to any of that is if you do have something that's interesting, you want to investigate it, you somehow have to find the money to get it done.
Right.
And so that involves getting researchers that are interested in the topic that then need to write grants or do whatever, you know, to try and secure funding so that the testing or so the investigation can be done, so to speak.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. And so before we kind of really dive into our topic, what genetic testing do you use on your farm? And then kind of really quickly, where do you see the benefit as a breeder? And then also to kind of expand on that as a buyer as well.
Mm-hmm. So I think, obviously I'm a Nubian breeder. And so for, we actually, the first genetic testing that our herd was ever involved in was actually a buck that we had sold to Canada. And one of the requests that came back, this was quite a few number of years ago now, maybe probably 20 years ago, was could you G6S test the buck? And it was like not on our radar at that time at all. And mom was like, sure. And then the buck came back as a G6S carrier. And of course that led off. I mean, I was actually living in New Zealand at the time, and I get this panicking email from my mom being like, what is this disease? And, you know, so I have to admit at the time, it really hadn't kind of been on the ADGA, you know, Nubian breed radar. Like we weren't really looking for it. And so, you know, we ended up testing our whole herd at that time. And not actually because we culled for the gene, but because the carrier animals ended up not being what we wanted to continue with in our herd, we actually ended up breeding it out. So our herd is now G6S normal, the whole herd. We're working on DNA typing. So we DNA type any buck that we sell off of the farm, and include it in the purchase price of the animal. And I think that really just, I think it's a good sales practice. It gives people confidence in the, you know, that they're getting the animal that they paid for. We don't have all our does DNA typed yet. We're working towards that. But all of our bucks have been DNA typed for quite a number of years now. And so our kids almost all come sire verified. I did use some older semen this year, so that's a little different. But yeah, so I think you know, it's really good from a selling perspective to give our, you know, buyers confidence that A, the animals are G6S normal, and B, that that their pedigree is correct. And then when I buy animals, I mean, the first question I always ask when I see a doe that I love and I'm interested in a buck is she G6S normal? And are you going to breed her to a G6S normal buck? And it's not that I don't think we should be working with G6S genetics. There are some incredible G6S carriers who have traits and qualities that are amazing. And the Nubian breed would not be the Nubian breed that it is today without Frosty Marvin, who was a carrier.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, like, so you have to, and it is an easy genetic trait to work with because it's recessive. Right. So as long as you only breed, you know, a non-carrier to your carriers, you know, and test the animals and are honest and open about it, I think that there is no reason not to use carriers. I can tell you when you get to the point where your herd is all normal by parentage, it becomes very hard to bring in a carrier, right? Even if it has all the other genetic traits that you want. But for people that do have carriers, it's like, I would I would not forgo really good genetics just because they carry the G6S trait if I was already working with carriers.
Right. And for those that might not be aware, maybe non-Nubian breeders or just beginners that do listen to this podcast, when we're talking about G6S, what are we talking about exactly?
So it's basically a storage deficiency of glycogen,
which is it's a product of metabolism that doesn't break down correctly. And so you get accumulation because the enzyme that breaks it down is missing. And it results in basically stunted growth, neurologic defects. Looking back many, many years ago, I believe we probably had at least one affected animal in our herd. Thinking back to what her clinical symptoms were, just like a kid that looks pretty normal at birth and looks fine and then never grows, had like seizure-like activity. They get a really stilted gait. If there's anybody that's interested, Running River Nubians in Oregon, they had a affected doe that they followed for many years, and she wrote a blog about it. Documented pictures from when the kid was young until they kept her, never bred her, until she passed away. And it kind of really demonstrates what happens to an animal when they're G6S positive, meaning they have two bad copies of the gene and not just a carrier.
Perfect. Thank you. Awesome explanation. Like, that was absolutely perfect. And for those that, getting onto the DNA side of things real quick, obviously people that have collected animals have gone through the steps, but if somebody's thinking about pulling hairs for DNA or using straws, they might feel like it's a daunting task, even though it's really not. Can you kind of walk us through the process of collecting samples and then submitting it?
Yeah, so obviously there's a form that you can order the test, quote unquote, test kits through from ADGA. Once you have that test kit, which is really just a piece of paper with the form that you need to submit to the lab, to collect the hair samples, you can use, what I use being a veterinarian is a pair of mosquito forceps, but you want something that you can clamp quite tightly and that has a relatively small head. So needle nose pliers actually work really well. Forceps of any kind. I find that tweezers don't work very well. It kind of slips through. So I think needle nose pliers for your general lay person is probably the best thing to pull hair. And what you're going to do, I like to pull... I actually find the nicest root bulbs, the biggest root bulbs, are the tail hairs on the side of the tail, because the hair there is a little more coarse, so the root bulb is bigger, and the root bulb is where the DNA is, and so the bigger the root ball, the more DNA you're going to be able to extract from it. So I actually take it from the side of the tail, most of my samples, or from the kind of, you know how they grow a little bit longer hair right down over the wither, down the top line? I'll take it from there as well sometimes. And you really want to get, they say 20 to 40 root balls. I go for about double that number. And one is you get a little bit of breakage of hair or whatever. So I usually put 2 to 3 good clumps of hair into my envelope. And any envelope, just be careful when you're doing it that you keep things clean. Don't cross-contaminate. Make sure that once you put the hair from one animal into an envelope that it is sealed and moved, and then start on your next animal so you don't accidentally cross-contaminate it. Make sure that your needle nose pliers don't have hair stuck in it from the next animal, from the first animal. And then you just, package it up in your envelope and send it to the lab. The other thing that I think is a really good practice is to take a set of samples for yourself and store them. And if you just store them in a cool, dry place, I know a lot of people put silica packets with them to keep them dry. That way, if there's any ever issues with the testing, you have a backup sample.
As for semen, semen does not have to be frozen. It can be thawed. And what I do is I just put it in a small Ziploc envelope and I put it in the, and then I put it in a paper, a Ziploc bag, and then I put it in the paper envelope and send it to the lab. That way, if it does leak, it doesn't ruin your envelope and they can probably still recover the semen from the Ziploc bag.
Right. And now, can you use a straw that you've already AI'd a dough with? Is there enough DNA still left in that straw, or does it have to be that full straw of semen?
So in general terms, a spent straw does not have adequate DNA to be able to test from. There are, in special circumstances, like if there were like half a straw left and you were doing something like in vitro fertilization or something like that, you could actually use half the straw and then save half the straw, but that would be something that you actually need to talk to the performance program manager, talk to the lab about before you ever get to the stage of doing that, right? It would be a very special circumstance where you might split a straw. But yeah, less than a half a straw is not going to get you enough DNA to be able to do typing.
Yeah. And then, you know, thinking forward, you know, everybody's going to kind of need to learn how to do this if they've never done it before, because in January of 2023, all books registered must be typed. So with your thoughts on this, how is this a good thing for dairy goats? And, you know, everybody knows the boar industry, boar registry used to do it, and it was mandatory, and they've kind of gone away from that. Thoughts on that?
So, yeah. So, well, one, just to clarify, it's all bucks must be DNA typed in order to register offspring. So they can be registered without being DNA typed, but if you ever want to register any of their offspring, then they have to be DNA typed. My two cents on that is that if you're going to register a buck, you should DNA type it at the time you register it, because you never know what happens, and you don't want kids on the ground and you haven't actually DNA typed the buck and something happens to him and you didn't ever DNA type him. So I would say, from a practical standpoint, people should be doing it when they register the buck kid. From the rules standpoint, it just needs to be done before the kids are registered. And then in terms of DNA typing, so one of the things is that I don't know, like from the Boar Goat Association, like I don't know what, how many exclusions they were having, if they were having a lot of exclusions or not very many exclusions when they implemented the program. And then when they stopped the program, whether that played into it or not. I would say that since DNA, so over the pandemic period, when we lost a lot of our other programs, so we didn't have linear appraisal for a year. A lot of places like California, we did not have a single show in 2020. So a lot of people kind of put their money into other programs, including DNA typing. And we just saw a massive expansion of the number of animals being DNA typed over the last few years. Well, with that came a massive expansion of the number of exclusions that were being seen. And so this growing pain period where we're doing all this DNA typing, we're going to find these. But if you think about it, in 5 years, if every single buck that has registered offspring has DNA on file, when we do have these exclusions, when the goat is 8 years old, so in, you know, what, 10 years from now, there's a relatively higher chance that the other sire, the real sire, will be somewhere in the registry to find. Right. And so because we have a voluntary program right now, we are having people DNA typing 8-year-old bucks that have 37 offspring or 40 offspring, or, you know, and the downstream effects is actually hundreds of animals. Because it's voluntary, but we ask them to parent to verify, you know, we have these issues where
the other potential sires, there might not be any semen, they might be dead, you know, and so we can't necessarily resolve them through DNA. And so I think that the really great thing about a mandatory buck program is that all of a sudden we have basically the entire database of bucks, you know, with the exception of the 6-month-old buck that is still nursing his mother and bred the other does in the pen.
But he was wearing an apron. It never could have happened.
Right. So, you know, it's though, you know, we still are going to have those types of situations, but I think the vast majority of exclusions will actually be resolvable with the new system.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, once you start having the sires on file, it does save you the hiccups down the line, because you can say, oh, well, maybe it's not this one, but then, all right, let's try these three, instead of going, oh my gosh, it could be this one, but I don't have DNA on him, and this guy's dead, and this guy got sold to this 4-H'er that I'm not going to be able to get, you know, I don't even know if he's still alive, and all of a sudden your animal, it just becomes a crazy mess.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think, you know, that's definitely one of the advantages to the new program.
Yeah.
So what do you do if you have an exclusion where, you know, there's, say, sire unknown, you know, the one that you submitted didn't match? What are the steps to try to find a match? And then if, said, say, the actual sire that you think it is isn't on file and he's long dead, is that just a dead end, or is there anything else that you could do as a breeder?
Yeah. So basically, when there's an exclusion, the performance programs manager contacts the breeder and or the owner, and the owner if the owner is not the breeder, right? So we have situations where it's a breeder submitted sample, and so they would just be like dealing with the breeder. But there are situations where an animal has been sold and then it comes back as an exclusion. So then you now have the breeder and owner involved. And it starts with just an investigation of, do we know what the other potential sires are? Do any of them have DNA on file? Are any of them alive? Like, trying to figure out what happened so that they can help resolve the problem. If there are, you know, in certain situations, the breeder's like, oh yeah, all my bucks are on file, so test against, and gives us the names of those bucks, and they test against the names of those bucks. And if they find the actual sire, then we just update the pedigree, they get new papers, and then that pedigree is resolved. Now the situation where they are unable to locate the actual parent, either there's no DNA available, or like you said, it's been sold 6 times and they can't find the buck, or whatever it might be. In those situations, it is a much more fluid process. And we've intentionally tried to keep it so that the performance programs manager can work with the breeder and the EC and the owner to try and resolve the pedigree in any way that they feel gives good confidence that the pedigree is resolved. Now, there are techniques for deriving profiles, which is, I think, what you were getting at. And The lab sets the standards for those. And the ability to derive a pedigree, there is no standard by which you can say you need X number of animals to derive a pedigree. Because of the way that DNA typing is done. So for the audience to know, basically there's a bunch within our DNA, or within a goat's DNA, there's a bunch of what are called short tandem repeats, which are basically sections of DNA that are like CA, 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 or TG, TG, TG. Like they're the nucleotides that repeat themselves in a certain number of like lengths over and over and over again. And we can use those short tandem repeats that are like dispersed throughout the genome
to DNA type because they pass by normal Mendelian genetics. Like you get one copy from your mom and one copy from your dad. And the lab reports, and I can't remember exactly, it's either like 15 or 18, somewhere 15 to 18 of those short tandem repeats they report out when they like report a parentage verification. But they can actually run way more than that. So when they're deriving a pedigree, they would take the offspring of said buck and they would run all of these short tandem repeats, and then they would see which ones were derived profile. Now, depending on what animals those, you know, who the parents were. So if it was a buck bred to a bunch of his sisters, that's going to be a lot harder to determine the profile than if it was like an outcross. Right. And so if you have the dams on file, then it potentially becomes easier to figure it out. But there's just no like standard answer. The lab can work with us on any of those cases to derive a profile. And we've said that we will accept derived profiles if it comes down to that. But if there's not really a standard answer as to this is how many goats you need to derive a profile. Probably you need 10 to start with if you don't have the dams on file, and 5 if you do have the dams on file to start with. Right. But it could end up, you could end up needing more than that.
And so let's say twin bucks. So let's say you go, oh shoot, it could be buck A or buck B and they're full siblings. How crazy does that get?
Well, again, so it could actually be totally fine. Like we inherit, so mom and dad have 2 copies each of every single short tandem repeat, and the sire does as well. And so you can, for every short tandem repeat that the offspring gets, they could have gotten either A or B from mom or A or B from dad. So you can actually have quite a lot of diversity in siblings until you start really heavily inbreeding. So if you have really heavily inbred siblings, then it becomes more difficult. And those are cases where at the lab, they have to use 50 markers to determine which is the sire, because they don't differ by that many, but rarely, rarely have they ever had a case where they couldn't resolve it between 2 sires that are super related.
And how common is this right now in the ADGA world,
that we have issues exclusions. Like that. Yeah. I mean, so I would say that we have seen an uptick in the number of exclusions, but I don't know that it's actually increased as a percentage of the total population. I think it's increased because more people are DNA testing and we're just finding more of them. You know, as a genetic advancement committee chair, I'm not privy to any of the exclusions. It is something that we, you know, will be notified of if there's animals that might not be resolvable. You know, we'll be told not who they are, but that there is an animal that might not be resolvable. In terms of, we do have an increased number of exclusions. But probably as a percentage of the total tests, it's not changed a lot over the years.
Right.
No,
and it's
relatively spread across breeds.
Yeah. No, I think it's one of those things that unfortunately it's taken such kind of, there's a level of shame with it. And so people kind of go, this has happened. And I think the attitude kind of needs to shift. As long as the breeders that are trying, you know, the breeders that have this exclusion are trying to fix it and get the pedigree correct, I think that's the, you know, that's what you want. Ultimately, that's the end goal. But I think when we bring it out into the light, it just becomes something that it's a little less scary for everyone. And we're not, you know, waiting on Jerry to bring out the envelope every time. And, you know, the whole crowd's going, Jerry, 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 trying to figure out, you know, who are you the father? But I think just bringing it to light and saying that it does happen goes a long way, because I mean, I know there's been herds that have just been dragged through. I mean, some herds haven't been willing to work with people and like find, you know, fix the pedigrees, but there's been other herds that have just been dragged through the mud because of this happening. And, you know, they try to fix it and they're getting their pedigrees back and correct, but it's just, there's almost this level of shame that I don't necessarily know if it should be there, but that's just my
opinion. Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, Danielle. And I think that the vast majority, and not all, but the vast majority of exclusions are honest mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that I will never have one, but you know, it's just one of those things, like goats are wily. they figure out how to do things, and you know, sometimes you just can't stop biology. And you know, I think the vast majority are honest mistakes, and people do everything they can to, you know, help fix it. And I think that's another reason why the DNA program is important, because it really helps to prevent the honest mistake, and it will find the ones that are not honest mistakes.
Right. Now, so kind of moving on and talk, I want to talk about some of the other tests that we can do as breeders, but the real quick, before we kind of dive into what the different tests are, I know we talked about G6S and things like that, but when you are submitting hair samples or semen samples for DNA typing, and you know you want to run more than just a DNA sample, let's say if you have a newbie and you want to run the G6S as well, do you have to worry about sending a bigger sample of hair, or is your typical 20 to 40 enough?
The typical 20 to 40 should get you the ability to do all four. So for Nubian would be four things. It would be DNA typing, G6S, casein, and scrapie.
Right.
It should be enough. There's no guarantee that it's going to be enough. And you might get asked if, you know, for more hair or additional sample. Same with a straw of semen, like from one straw of semen, you should be able to run all those things. But again, there's no hard and fast rule. Part of it also has to do with the quality of the sample by the time it gets to the lab. So, you know, the extracting DNA from the samples, you know, if you have a sample that's really old and, you know, sat on your dashboard of your car for 3 weeks, and then you, you know, put it by the sink and it got a little wet, and then you sent it off to the lab, you know, and the U.S. Postal Service, like, took 3 weeks for it to get to the lab, well, that sample might not have as good quality DNA. And so you might be able to run less tests on it. So it just really depends. But yeah, in general, you should be able to get everything out of one sample.
Okay. And then let's say you DNA type, and then 2 years down the road, you want to do, you know, an alpha casein test on that animal. Does the lab have the hair still stored, or is the information already there, they just have to find it, or how does that work?
Yeah, so the hair sample is long gone. The hair sample is digested, or the process to extract the DNA is done. But once your animal has been DNA typed or even G6S tested, they have the DNA on file. And so you should be able to, so this is a really kind of from, for ag members, a good thing to know is that once you have any sort of DNA on file, so if you decided to alpha casein test and now you want a DNA type, or vice versa, or G6S test or whatever, you don't have to submit a new sample. You just need to do a DNA request form to the performance programs manager and write on there that the animal already has DNA at the lab, and could you add this test on? And that can be done. I've done that. We used a buck from a breeder that had tested, had DNA typed him for semen collection, but had never G6S tested him. And so we just asked her if we paid for the G6S testing, if we could use her DNA sample, and she okayed that. And then we ordered it on the DNA that was already on file.
Right. No, I've done that the same thing, or for alpha, once alpha caseins became a thing, I started testing my herd and was able to, you know, do that and didn't have to resubmit. But you totally crushed my dream of it, imagining UC Davis lab with just rows and rows of same hair that they're just going to be like, oh shoot, this one's clean to be tested again. Let's find this like packet of hair from 20 years ago.
Be like the Harry Potter bookshop. Yeah,
exactly.
Rose.
No, this is probably definitely a better way to do it than, you know, keeping the cabinets of hair. And I mean, I can't imagine the amount of files that they would have. But anyway, moving on.
Smells like buck in there 24/7.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, so, and they do, they have tons of samples. They don't just, I mean, they don't just have ADCA samples. They also do a bunch of dogs, horses, cattle, all sorts. So.
But we know the bucks smell the worst out of all those.
Yes,
right?
That's true.
Now, we're talking about the alpha casein test and scrapie's resistance tests. And what are those and how are those beneficial as well?
So the alpha S1 casein, so basically this is a gene for one of the caseins that goats make in their milk. And it's been shown that the high alleles, so the A and B alleles, which an allele is basically just like the gene that you inherited. And there are many different alleles for the alpha S1 casein. So it's still Mendelian genetics. Like if your mom has an A and an A and your dad has a B and a B, you're going to be an AB. But there's not just A and B. There's A and B and N and O1 and F. I think that's all. And E. And each one of those is associated with a certain level of this casein. And casein is really important in cheese making in terms of yield, how much cheese you get from a gallon of milk. And so a lot of cheesemakers are going after the A and B alleles, which give them the higher protein content. Those are also linked to having higher butter fat, which is also useful. So it's interesting. It's one of these, we don't know. It's not that the gene has anything to do with butter fat. It's just that animals that carry the high allele also have higher butter fat. Mm-hmm. And then the low alleles, a lot of people are interested in the null or the low alleles because casein is one of the kind of allergenic proteins in milk. And so people that are not tolerant of drinking milk, that can't digest it very well, they find that they can digest the low casein milk better. And so there are people that are actually selecting for the low casein. I heard at the ADGA convention, I think in 2018, Amelia Sweetheart, who is a cheesemaker from Texas, gave a really interesting talk. And one of her points was that we don't completely want to get rid of the low alleles, even as cheesemakers, because some of the more interesting flavors actually come from the lower alleles instead of the high alleles tend to be the most mild flavored. And so she was very cognizant of like keeping, even though she wants to make more cheese, keeping some of the lower alleles in her herd.
No, that's interesting. And yeah, I think there definitely is a push. I mean, I know that the alpha S1 caseins are definitely semi-breed specific as what is, you know, where the higher population of certain, you know, yeah, like an A or a B. And so I know Nubians typically have more of the A's and B's, and then Alpines, at least from what I was seeing, there was a push to have animals with those A's and B's. But like you said, when you start breeding for that, what are you losing as well? Right. So that's interesting to think that, you know, if we concentrate on one direction and it has its advantages, but we're also losing a little bit of different flavor profiles too.
The Nubians and the Nigerians are basically almost all high alleles, and then there is the Alpine breeders have made there's a number of Alpine breeders have made a cognizant effort to get more A and B, and even I was actually talking to somebody at a show yesterday about Fawnins and the B allele, because they do carry the B allele, and then there's Toggenbergs that carry the A allele. So and there are people that are working on bringing those into their herds. So
very cool. And so now let's talk scrapies, which I feel like is the newest test that's available, but also definitely the one that we don't hear about very much. And I almost feel like this could be a huge game changer for us as breeders.
So it definitely can. So for people that don't know, scrapie is a disease. It's an infectious disease that is caused by a prion protein. So it's in the same family as mad cow disease. And in humans, the disease is called Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And it basically, this protein prion causes protein misfolding in the brain, and you basically end up with holes in your brain and you lose cognitive function. We in the sheep world in the United States, in my childhood, I remember it being kind of devastating. I had a fellow 4-H member who ended up with scrapie in his Suffolk show herd, and the devastating thing is that at that time it was culled the entire herd. Everything was killed. And in goats, that was until recently would have still been the standard of how we dealt with a scrapie outbreak in the US. But now that we have resistance alleles, there is the possibility that if your herd was involved in a scrapie outbreak, that if your animals were tested and they had the resistant alleles, that they could be spared potentially. So I think from that standpoint, the sheep people have used it extensively, and they have seriously increased the percentage of their national herd that carries the resistance alleles. The cool thing about the goats that is different to the sheep is that with the goats, you actually only need one copy of the resistance allele to be resistant to scrapie. Whereas with the sheep, you actually have to have both copies to be truly resistant. If you have one copy, it just takes longer for you to get sick. So goats are unique to sheep in that way. So from that point of view, it's from the US national herd point of view, it really gives us the ability to save herds or save genetics if they carry the resistance allele and they were involved in a scrapie outbreak.
Yeah, and there's a book that involved a sheep breeder. It was called Mad Sheep. And it was about a farm up in Maine that had imported animals, and they didn't test or something, and an animal showed signs of scrapies, so they just wiped out the whole herd or flock.
Yep.
And it's a pretty interesting book. It's a terrible story, but it's cool that we've come so far, because I mean, this was late 80s, early 90s, maybe, that this took place. So we've come a long way since then.
That was a very typical scenario in those days. That was my childhood. Like, there was a lot of scrapie outbreaks when I was a kid, and whole herds were being depopulated because of it. Mm-hmm. And then the other interesting thing, though, is, I know you had Kylie and Alex on, and it's the export thing is really interesting. And so it's actually certain countries have different approaches to this. So having the resistance allele does not mean you were never exposed to scrapie. It just means you didn't get sick from scrapie, right? And so countries like Canada and Australia, for sheep, they actually require that the animal be a susceptible genotype. So they don't want the resistance allele because they don't want to accidentally bring in scrapie in an animal that's resistant to it. Whereas Mexico, if you can show in sheep that the resistance allele is in the animal, then you can export animals to Mexico. Nobody yet has cottoned on to the fact that we now have resistance alleles in goat. So there's no rules related to goats for Canada, Australia, or Mexico about resistance alleles and export of animals.
Do you think that'll come though and maybe help open the border to Canada for exporting? Or even with, I mean, I know with Australia, part of the reason why they have to use an animal, or sorry, euthanize an animal post-collection is to perform that scrapies test on them post-mortem as well as other tests. But do you think that that is something that we'll see down the line, that maybe if this animal, if like, let's say a buck has the scrapies resistant genes, that his semen can get exported into Canada again, or, you know?
Yeah. So, right. So it has actually, it'll be based on the current sheep protocol, it would actually be the opposite.
Okay.
That, so it would actually become, so as a Nubian breeder, actually Nubians carry like about 50% of our herd carries a resistance allele. And we know that because the USDA NOMS study did a bunch of testing of goats in their last goat survey in 2019. And they came and did our herd, and the 50% of the animals that they tested carried a resistance allele. So we have a really high percentage of the resistance allele in our herd. And so this would actually make it harder for us to export those bucks that have the resistance allele.
Wow. That's interesting. You would think it would be the other way.
It's because Australia considers themselves to be free of scrapie. And so when you have a buck that carries a resistance allele, what you can't guarantee is that he isn't harboring scrapie, but not diseased.
Right.
Is their thinking.
Okay. I mean, I can see that, but man, oof. Okay.
Whereas it would be easier to export to Mexico, who wants the resistance alleles.
Right. Exactly. Now, we'll kind of wrap it up here in a second, but I just wanted to ask, and I know, Daniel, this is kind of your question, but Daniel saw that you had something posted on Facebook about color genetics and kind of the word of caution when trying to use color genetics to validate parentage, particularly in Nigerian dwarf goats. Would you mind kind of touching on that?
Yeah, here's the thing. So Dr. Sponnenberg, who is like the father of animal genetics and particularly color genetics, is amazing. And so he wrote all these early papers on goat color genetics that are amazing papers. And if you have the chance and you're interested in color, you should go and read them. And he basically was able to take enough breedings and color phenotypes that he could figure out how the genes were being passed. But that was it all based on phenotype. So it's not based on a genetic testing at all. It's based on who was passing what to whom. And more recently, we've started to discover people, not in this country, but in other countries, are doing studies on color genetics in goats, and they're finding some really cool things, like the number, some genes you actually carry lots of copies of the gene, and that makes you like a lighter or a darker color of the same gene, right? So a white to cream actually can be just carrying different numbers of the same gene. And so there's so much to learn about color genetics in goats. And I think, like, for, unfortunately, like, my opinion for, like, the Nigerians and Nubians, like, it doesn't really matter. It does not matter what color they are. They can be any color. There's no requirement for their color. So it doesn't matter. I do think that even based on the evidence that we have from Spanenburg that shows that only certain colors should come from certain colors, that it is never, period, end of story, okay to register a goat if you are not sure of the parentage based on the color. Because the other thing is that even a lot of Spanenburg's work was done with European goats, not with American genetics. The Nigerian dwarf goat, we know from their origins and how the breed was created, likely contain several other breeds in their genetic makeup. The blue eyes certainly is an unusual trait for a dairy animal. And, you know, some of the, like, where did the moon spots come from? You know, like, those kinds of things. So yes, I think way in their genetic background now, because the breed was made based on phenotype only. You brought an animal to the committee and said, this animal looks like a Nigerian, and the committee either said yes or no, and the animal was registered as Nigerian. So it didn't have anything to do, like, there was, you didn't have to show any breeding pedigree, anything. So that makes, they have a lot of unique traits that we might not see in the other breeds. So registering based on color, I don't think is great. It's not a good idea.
No, I agree.
Some of the other breeds are really interesting. So the Oberhasli breed, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's this kind of chestnut Oberhasli that you get. And Dr. Spanenburg has actually been really interested in the chestnut Oberhasli. And it would be actually very similar to what we might see in horses with bay versus chestnut. Potentially. So it is actually something that I've been contacted by about Oberhasli breeders that they are interested in potentially pursuing further. The other ones would be like Toggenburg Black. A lot of people know who their black carriers are, right? But if we actually had a genetic test for black, and then the whole Son and Sable thing, right? Being able to determine if a buck is a sable carrier. Now, it's really easy. You just breed a Sonnen buck to a black doe or a colored doe. If he has colored kids, he carries sable because white is dominant, right? Uh-huh. So there are non-genetic testing ways to look at color. But yeah, there are some really interesting things in some of the colored breeds that may warrant development of genetic tests.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, those chestnut Oberhasli certainly are interesting, for sure. And then, you know, there's going to be, I'm sure, somewhere down the line, and this is probably 20 or 30 years from now, like, Guernsey breeders are going to want to do genetic testing on which animals carry the longer hair gene. Carry on, you know, like, the future is just endless as far as what we could really test for. So it's exciting, and you know, it's really interesting to hear you expand on everything for us today. Was there anything, Fauna, that you would like to kind of expand further on before we wrap this up?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we got a pretty good coverage of everything. I just I encourage people to utilize the, you know, genetic programs that ADGA offers. I know that things have been a little rough lately, but the tests are great tests, and they can provide a lot of value to you and your herd. And so I encourage people to utilize them where it makes sense for them.
Yeah, perfect. Daniel, did you have any further questions?
No, I think that's it. Thank you so much, Fauna, for coming on and talking to us. And as always, where can we find you? Where can we find your herd?
So we have wingwoodfarm.com is our website. And then we're on Facebook, Wingwood Farm. if you are interested in emailing me or talking to me about genetic advancement stuff, I used my flsmith@ucdavis.edu email address.
Perfect. And we'll also tag the farm and you on the show notes here for the show. But yeah, Dr. Fauna Smith, thank you so much for joining us today. Danielle, where can the folks find us on the old social medias?
So you can find us, if you're on Facebook, by searching Ringside and American Dairy Goat Podcast. We are on Instagram at Ringside_Goat_Podcast. And then we are on TikTok and Twitter as well. So be sure to follow us, give us a like, all of those fun things.
Yeah, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Fauna Smith, I can't wait to have you back on someday. This has been very interesting.
I know, especially the new job. We're going to have, congratulations. We're going to have start picking your brain about other things now. So for better or for worse for you.
I'd be happy to come back.
All right, well, everybody, this has been Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Danielle.
We'll catch you on the next one. Ringside, an American Dairy Goat Podcast, is not an affiliate of the American Dairy Goat Association. All opinions or information regarding the ADGA does not represent the registry.